Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 2nd, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In the 3 weeks since the powerful magnitude 9 earthquake which devastated Japan on March 11th, the basement team of the LaRouche Youth Movement has been engaged in a crash project to look into the profound scientific issues raised by the earthquake, from which we can develop a predictive capability to save lives in the face of the next earthquake, and also to give us a better understanding of the creative and powerful forces at work in our universe. The preliminary results have shown that there are scientists who have been working in these areas, looking into the correlations between solar activity, the electromagnetic fields of the Earth, and seismic activity. And we've put some of this up in a series of very provocative interviews on the LaRouche PAC website, which have taken up this question of the rim of fire. And by looking into these areas, what we're discovering is that scientists have been investigating precisely the areas that the basement is investigating, looking into the broad field of cosmic radiation. We've also found something which confirms what, unfortunately, we already knew, that there is a controlling factor which dominates the scientific community, which rejects the idea that there can be successful forecasting. And it's this factor, which is funded heavily by the same group of banks and financial circles that represent the Anglo-Venetian Empire. It's the same factor which promotes an anti-scientific, anti-human view, which, if not overturned, will leave our human civilization defenseless in the face of the natural powerful forces which we will encounter as our solar system moves into an area of the galaxy which we have not entered since man emerged in our solar system. Not surprisingly, this factor, which is controlling the funding of science and many of the publications and research centers, also controls the President of the United States, who is taking down the scientific efforts which could advance the real predictive science. For example, the cancellation of the Destiny satellite and the slashing of NASA's budget. This president is acting on behalf of the financial faction of the Anglo-Venetian Empire, centered in the bankrupt Inter Alpha Group. And these are forces committed to reducing the world's population by as many as 5 billion people. And the President of the United States, regrettably, is their puppet. And for that reason, he must go immediately. On today's program, I'm going to be joined by Peter Martinson from the LaRouche Basement Team. Peter can be seen on several of the provocative interviews and discussions on LaRouche PAC on the Rim of Fire. We'll also be joined by Ali Perabakovsky from the Summer Shields Congressional campaign in San Francisco, and we're going to be discussing both the scientific issues involved and the political fight to reverse the long-term attack on science. So Peter and Ali, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley.
Thanks, Harley.
And Ali is somewhere near the San Andreas Fault, and my title for this program was Don't Blame San Andreas, It's Obama's Fault. So we'll be taking up that issue as we go on. But Peter, let me start with you, because I understand that Lyndon LaRouche today pushed ahead the work that you're engaged in with the discussion of the Crab Nebula. What was he discussing this morning, and what are the broader implications of this question?
Well, first, Mr. LaRouche pointed at two reports that went up on our website last night, one of which was done by Alicia Cheritani, and one which was done by Matt Ogden, both of them looking at this issue of the so-called earthquake precursors and the fact that we could be forecasting these things if we didn't have Obama in office. But in particular, he referenced the fact that starting tomorrow, there will be a conference in Vienna, it's the equivalent of the European Geophysical Society. And one aspect of the conference proceedings will include a presentation and a whole section of the conference chaired by a scientist named Francesco Biaggi of Italy, who's one of the top one of the top scientists in Europe, looking at different forms of electromagnetic and other precursors to earthquakes. And what he will present is the fact that up to about a week and a half before the Japanese earthquake hit, there was at least one group in Japan who did recognize the oncoming earthquake in some of these precursors in what he calls radio waves that are that react around the time of an earthquake. He says that they recognized it, and it isn't clear whether they actually whether they warned the government and the government didn't respond, or whether they were prevented from warning the government by, you know, scientific colleagues and the whole backwardsness of science in general. But that will be presented today, and that's the second example that we've heard from the basement of people recognizing precursors up to a week and a half before this devastating earthquake in Japan. Now, so we report on that in the two reports. Lynn and LaRouche goes a step further. We do need to, accelerate the science of being able to understand when earthquakes and volcanoes and disasters will hit the Earth. But LaRouche, he takes all of this and puts it into a different context. Proceeding from what he and Sky Shields discussed at the end of his weekly report on Wednesday, in terms of what the implications are from this nebula that some people know of called the Crab Nebula, which is one of the first named nebulas. The thing exploded in 1054 AD. It was witnessed by Chinese astronomers and recorded back then. But it's a giant object that spans a dozen or so light years across.
Peter,
it's about
what exactly
6,000 light years away from us?
What exactly is a nebula?
Well, it's not clear. It's a section of the galaxy that's lit up by cosmic radiation. Now, this is the thing. People understand today the Crab Nebula as being lit up and energized by a very tiny central star object that's they call a pulsar, a neutron star. Mm-hmm. It's really dense, really energetic, and so forth. And that it's driving the intense radiations coming from this object. And it's the brightest celestial object that we have in all wavelengths of light, even in gamma rays. But over the past year or two, it was observed that the object became brighter in the gamma radiations, on the highest energetic radiation we know of. It became brighter about sixfold. It increased in brightness over 4 days, up to six times its usual energy output in the gamma rays, and then decreased right away over a period of 5 or 6 days.
Hmm.
It did this twice that we know of in the past 2 or 3 years.
Hmm.
Now, the way Mr. LaRouche, the way the scientists try to explain it is that we have to throw all of our science out, because whatever could create this type of change over a span of, you know, a dozen light years, over that short a period of time, is a physics that we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
What Lyndon LaRouche says is that this is not a phenomenon that's happening within the galaxy, but that this is a phenomena of the galaxy right now. That the galaxy as a whole is going through a very significant generation process now, a creative process. It's by no means a dead, already, you know, built galaxy. So all of the work that we're doing in terms of earthquake research, the relationship of activity with the sun, has to take into account the fact that we live inside of a galaxy that's a connected whole that produces phenomena like the Crab Nebula.
Well, Peter, let me ask you, because you said that there were sort of two conflicting views. One, throw out all the science. The other, Lynn saying that this is part of the galaxy. But it seems to me that what we're looking at is having to throw out what has become the dominant view of so-called dynamics in the universe, which is the view that the second law of thermodynamics is a total universal principle. And that this is, of course, something that LaRouche has been attacking for years, but what we're looking at in the Crab Nebula pretty much confirms that, doesn't it?
Well, like the usual scientific explanation of the Crab Nebula is that it's a star that has died, And what we're watching are the death throes of this dying star as it runs down and runs out of energy. But what the recent phenomena indicate, and what we know from the work on Kepler, the work on Riemann, and the work on Vernadsky, and then Lynn and LaRouche's conception of the anti-entropic development of the universe, what we're looking at is a process that is in very, very rapid development in a creative direction. By no means does this represent something that's dying down. And Sky actually pointed out something interesting. The central star that supposedly is powering all this wild phenomena inside this Crab Nebula, there were no changes that were observed at this from the star. It didn't do anything while the whole Crab Nebula was being, while it was brightening up six times in the gamma radiation, which means that it's a phenomena that's generating the Crab Nebula as if from the outside. Mm-hmm. So what this means is that the science that people are using to try to explain this stuff, it's kind of like your grandpa's crusty underwear that, you know, you should probably throw that in the burn pile.
Yeah, don't even try and wash it.
Yeah, get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, we were talking with Peter Martinson of the Basement team on the really fascinating work that's coming out. And, of course, when I use the word fascinating, I don't mean it's the kind of thing we can sit back and contemplate over the next, you know, 60 years. But we're right now in a cycle of at least what appears to be highly expanded, energized electromagnetic phenomena. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Peter, in terms of this phenomena known as the Rim of Fire?
Okay, now, what we've been putting together in the basement for at least 2 years is an image of the development of the galaxy and the development of the solar system, and particularly as it's viewed from life on the Earth, that over the past several billion years of the development of the Earth and the development of life on the Earth, we've seen people know about what are called mass extinctions, that every once in a while, something happens on the Earth to wipe out almost all the animals, so that what comes in next is a completely different type of creature, like the dinosaurs got wiped out 65 million years ago, and mammals came in to take their place. Now, what's been determined is that the cycle of increasing and decreasing numbers of types of organisms on the Earth actually goes in a roughly 62 million year cycle. So every 62 million years, you get to a low point in number of types of organisms on the Earth, which coincides with these so-called mass extinctions. Now, what's also been recognized is that coinciding with that are motions of the Earth and the solar system through the galaxy that's also on a 62 million year cycle.
Hmm.
What also appears to be on the same cycle is increases and decreases in activity of earthquakes and volcanoes. So when most people that are involved in the science of earthquakes and so forth are pretty clear that the amount of pure release of motion on the Earth due to earthquakes is now at an accelerating upwards. The recent large earthquakes are part of a trend of more powerful earthquakes, but also just a lot more, even smaller earthquakes in general around the Earth. And it happens to also coincide with a change in the activity of the sun. Usually it goes through a cycle of 11 years of increasing and decreasing activity. This last time it went through a 13-year cycle, which included an extra long minimum. So what we're looking at is that we're at a point in the 62-million-year cycle where we're headed into a period that coincides with what are called mass extinctions, but also increases in tectonic activity like we should expect with these earthquakes. So the issue that we're looking at is we have to start developing our ability to forecast these earthquakes, because we know that there's an electromagnetic component that exists well before the earthquakes happen, up to a month before the earthquakes happen. We have to develop our ability to forecast them, knowing that we're headed into an area that's wiped out pretty much every type of organism that's ever existed on the Earth. We need
and
to be
Peter,
the first organism that has defeated that extinction.
There are some scientists who have been looking into this, and we had a report this morning on this one person in Italy who did a kind of a history of looking into the earthquake precursors. And you have people going back to Benjamin Franklin's time, Volta, Marconi, there's a couple of famous Italian people involved in looking at electricity. So this is not something that's new in terms of scientific research, but it's something that has been suppressed by the existing scientific establishment. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it actually goes back at least to Kepler. I mean, one interesting thing is one of the more reliable earthquake forecasters, Jim Birkeland, who forecasted that a window for a very large earthquake to hit the San Andreas occurred last week. He noted that it was also a rather wet period around the area. And he said that he'd never seen an earthquake when it wasn't dry out. Kepler noticed the same thing, that you never have earthquakes if it's raining or if the conditions are wet. It's always dry. Now, over the past 100 years, it's become clear that there are other indicators of earthquakes. Particularly, back in 1964, there was a giant earthquake that hit Alaska. Some old-timers might remember this, that a 9.4 magnitude earthquake hit
wow.
Alaska, and parts of Alaska dropped like 30 feet. But several hours before the earthquake hit, the United States Geological Survey actually had a magnetometer in the area that was measuring readings, and it went into a real wild variation, so-called ultra-low frequency variation. About 2 hours before the earthquake hit. Now, the USGS said, this thing is completely malfunctioning. Let's turn it off. But a couple other people said, well, maybe this is a precursor. And so after that, several scientists, many of whom actually live along the San Andreas Fault, started to try to measure electrical or magnetic variations around the time of earthquakes. And there's been some success. One particular one was before the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the so-called mm-hmm. World Series earthquake.
Right.
2 weeks before that quake hit, a scientist at Stanford actually measured changes in these ultra-low frequency variations of the Earth's magnetic field right in the region. Now, it was after that that Al Gore decided to reinstitute the National Earthquake Research, I forget what the exact name is, the government institute that prepares for earthquakes. But he specifically stated that no more will it be funded to predict earthquakes, but only to mitigate the damage done by earthquakes. And it was specifically in response to the fact that precursors were measured in 1989 and that the possibility of predicting these things did exist. Al Gore, you know, our friendly Malthusian in Washington, in Tennessee, decided that we should stop trying to predict earthquakes right then and there because it might actually save lives instead of wipe them out.
Well, and LaRouche-Pack has put out a statement that's on the website that we're going to be distributing widely, which essentially identifies this as criminal negligence, the policy of the Obama administration to tear down specifically programs that were designed to add to the knowledge we have so that we could do forecasting. So I would encourage people to go to the LaRouche-Pack website and get that and circulate it, because these things have to be reversed immediately if we're going to not just protect the planet, but advance science and a knowledge of the correlation so that we can get to a real predictive basis. I'm going to come to Ali in just a moment, but Peter, I had one more question for you, which is sort of a philosophical question of science. It would seem to me that scientists would go into these areas, including seismology, with a hunger to actually develop predictive capabilities to aid mankind. But it appears as though you have, especially from seismologists, this dominant, almost inquisition against people like Professor Biagi who are trying to look at these things and instead to keep people within a narrow band of reacting to events rather than trying to figure them out. Are we finding now from talking to scientists, because I know you and others are involved in outreach from the basement, that there is a hunger among scientists to take up these more profound questions?
Well, yeah, and I'm sure Allie can say more about this, too. There is more of an, you still run into, you know, the stodgy old guys who freak out when you try to say that we can forecast earthquakes. But we're in a mass strike right now, which is, as LaRouche has discussed repeatedly, this is a period of Percy Bysshe Shelley, as he lays out in the Defense of Poetry, where you reach a point where the population is more apt to be able to receive and impart profound ideas about the nature of man and the nature of the universe. And we shouldn't forget that scientists are also people. So yeah, we are actually finding an increased response and an increased excitement around the possibility of looking at these precursors, but not just to predict earthquakes, but because this is going to give us insight into processes that that were declared back in the 70s and 80s as, you know, we know how these things work. We know everything about earthquakes. We know everything about the insides of the earth. It just, you know, we just have to refine our measurements now. What a lot of these scientists are excited about now is that we can throw a lot of the dogma out and use these phenomena to do a reinvestigation of how does the Earth function as an integrated part of the solar system and the rest of the galaxy.
I thought it was very interesting that Biagi made this point that scientists can develop these capabilities to make predictions based on precursors, but they don't have the political power to move people out of an area which is predicted to be susceptible to an earthquake. And I think what we're actually talking about, and the basement is at the forefront of this, is that we develop science not as something outside of political life, but as a central feature of political life, so that these kinds of questions are straightforward. If you have evidence that shows we're about to get hit by something, the government immediately responds to that, as opposed to raising the question of, is it cost effective to move people and then find out it was a false prediction? Is that something that you think is, I mean, you see that as a real possibility now, this science and politics working together?
Yeah, all these guys that are looking into the precursors, they're pretty much all doing it on their own, you know, out of their own pockets. Some of it's being funded a little bit in Russia, France, and so forth, but nothing in the United States. Most of these guys just work on, you know, their own funding, or they have to fight like hell to get little peanuts from the government. But it's, if you look at just what happened with NASA, the conditions for advancing science are determined in large part by government policies. You know, are they going to fund certain types of projects? If they're going to shut down NASA by removing the human spaceflight capability like Obama is calling for, then that puts a limit on the types of scientific research that we can do. Like, we do have evidence of the earthquake precursors, but we need to do a lot more research in order to hone down our ability to use those precursors to forecast earthquakes, which means we need a lot more satellites in space to measure this stuff, which means we need an active human spaceflight component in the United States.
Well, I would urge people to... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, the government, what the government does is absolutely necessary for what the scientists do.
Right.
And the way we move the government is by making clear what the science is.
Well, I would urge people to go on the LaRouche PAC website and take a look at the new posting from Matthew Ogden on the discussion of Professor Biagi's research, and be sure to come back early this next week, because we're going to have, I'm sure, a report from this conference in Vienna where Professor Biagi is heading a panel, and we'll be presenting his material on the Japanese quake. So, Peter, stick around, because we're going to come back to you in a moment, but I want to go to our correspondent somewhere near the San Andreas Fault, at least the northern part of it, Ali Peribakovsky, who's out organizing around these conceptions. And, you know, there was some discussion among our membership of, well, how can we really take up these questions of the galaxy when people are losing their jobs, they're losing their homes, they're losing everything, and they're more interested in how do I get food stamps than they are what's happening in the Crab Nebula. But Ali, you've been out, from what you were telling me, you've been out organizing precisely around this concept, and you're finding what Peter just reported, that this mass strike process is making people more open to taking up the big ideas. Why don't you give us a little report on what you've been finding?
Sure. I can definitely do that. I guess the interesting thing about what is happening right now, both politically, economically, what's hitting the population is, and what most people can understand very well, is that we're entering a situation which is completely unprecedented for mankind. And I think this is something that LaRouche had, you know, gone through in the weekly report this last week, and you're seeing it hitting the population, both in the way that you see the complete collapse of an entire system of imperialism that's, you know, really governed mankind for several thousands of years. You're seeing the complete destruction of that system, and you're seeing a real challenge to humanity being posed. You know, will humanity be able to survive by, you know, completely dumping this system of the British Empire, of free trade, the system that Obama represents? You see the same thing with what's going on right now with the threats to the Pacific Rim of Fire, with the earthquake, and really with the direction that our solar system is moving in the galaxy. Mankind has not been around, you know, since the last time that our solar system moved into the position that it's moving in the galaxy, 65 million years ago, we weren't around back then. So the kind of what we're expecting right now is completely unprecedented. And it's almost like our sun and our galaxy is giving us almost a loving nudge or a loving push into the right direction, or maybe more like a shove, saying, you know, either you're going to evolve, either you're going to listen to the scientists, listen to reason and listen to what the universe is telling you, understand what's going on, what is our relationship to the universe, what is mankind all about, or you're going to go extinct. And, you know, it's really one of those things. So what we've been telling people is, look, we can do better than what we've had, than the prospect that we're facing right now. Because there's a lot of people who, you know, they've become a little bit pessimistic, seeing everything fall apart around them, seeing that they maybe don't have a job anymore. Their house is being taken from them, or they can't put food on their table to feed their families. And you just have to know that the nature of man is that we can do better than this, that we do change, that we do evolve, and that we have the capability to win right now. But the only way that we can win this political battle is if we take a look at these higher questions.
And Ali, let me ask you about that in particular, because I know that's what you're presenting to people. Once they get over the shock of stopping at a table talking to a congressional candidate and they realize he's talking about these great galactic issues, people are standing there and engaging in conversation, aren't they?
Yeah, of course they are. In fact, the better people will come up on that issue and will come up on the issue of not only the next earthquake. They don't come up because of some fear factor of, you know, oh, what will my family do if an earthquake comes? But they will come up and discuss these bigger issues of why is it that we're being challenged with this kind of a situation right now? So yeah, people are definitely they're coming up, and the thing we're challenging them on is there's no easy way out right now. You can't just think about, you know, some election in 2012 or something like that.
Well, what response are you getting when you tell them it's for precisely the criminal negligence of the Obama administration's attack on these programs that he has to go immediately? Are you finding that there's more openness on this question of getting him out?
Well, look, what this question that you're bringing up, the attack that Obama has made on NASA cutting these satellites is genocide. And the thing you can bring up with people is, look, this, what you're seeing right now is the deliberate, intentional destruction of human lives. What we've been asking people is, look, just look at what is his intention. Here you have a man who, throughout his entire administration, has attacked every ounce of creativity that this nation has had, which really, you know, programs like NASA, programs like the Scientific Outlook, our the Army Corps of Engineers, our teachers, our firefighters, that's what makes the United States the type of nation that it is. So here Obama's attacked this every step of the way. He's cutting the budget of cutting important satellites like this Destiny satellite out of the budget, wants to cut the GEOSS satellite out of the budget. These things, we know that these things can actually predict or, you know, give us precursors to earthquakes, to natural disasters. We know that this can happen. We know that the Army Corps of Engineers is the only competent body that can lead a mass evacuation of people so that we can save lives. And it's not like, compared to the $24 trillion or plus that we've given to bail out the banks, This is nothing. We're spending nothing on the budget of NASA, on the budget of these necessary programs that will directly impact human life.
And Peter, we are seeing things like letters from scientists protesting these cuts, are we not?
The Destiny satellite, there were several, and the Destiny satellite that's like just baseline watching the, it's a LIDAR satellite, so it can measure extremely fine motions of the actual crust of the Earth. It's just baseline observing that a lot of these Earth scientists have been begging for I think about two decades. Just recently it was actually put into the NASA budget, and then, you know, voila, on advice from Obama's science advisor, John Holdren, it was taken out of the budget. So I think about 15 or so scientists wrote to the advisory council to the president on earthquake preparedness to protest the fact that this satellite has been axed out of the budget.
Any response from Obama yet?
Yeah, right.
Do you go on vacation again?
I don't know where he is right now.
Well, and Peter, this kind of question of what will the scientists do? Now, I want to go deeper into this, and I want to come back to Allie also because of the really innovative work that she and Summer and others are doing on this to organize beyond the scientists to make this a functional issue of day-to-day politics in the United States. But I'd like to just ask you to go back to this question raised by Mr. LaRouche on the Crab Nebula. We're really dealing with things that are at the frontiers of science and man's actual knowledge of the universe. But Lynn keeps bringing this back to the question of how we think and how we have to develop capabilities to overcome sense certainty. And I know this is something that a number of our listeners have trouble with because they don't quite get it. But if you could just give a sense of how it is that this is a life and death issue now, I think that'd be very useful for people.
Well, one thing to remember, I mean, some people who are listening probably have seen some of the animations that we've made of the solar system bobbing up and down through the galaxy and then passing through the arms of the galaxy. But what might not be clear is that those pictures are pictures of other galaxies, not ours. We actually have no clear picture of our galaxy. We get a band of stars and luminous matter that we can see across the sky. That's about the best picture we can get of our galaxy, and then we have to extrapolate from there what the actual structure of the galaxy is, how far away the arms are, etc. So we can't actually see our galaxy. In a similar way, just recently we've had instruments to watch the activity of the sun, day-to-day activity of the sun. we don't have any instruments that are watching the Crab Nebula every single day. Hmm. The observations that were taken of the Crab Nebula were, a couple days here, a couple days there, bought by astronomers on telescopes designed for other issues. So there's a lot of phenomena happening in the galaxy which are not being observed by, there's no sense perception that's capable of picking those activities up. So what's posed by, the recent catastrophes with the earthquakes is that we need to have a sensorium to watch not only areas that people aren't looking at, but also, wavelengths of light that human beings are incapable of seeing, other types of cosmic radiation that human beings cannot see with their senses, some animals can see. But from the standpoint, Lynn made a good point today. He actually said you don't want to have one big satellite up there, but you want to have a whole bunch of so-called nano-satellites. You want to have a lot of satellites up there, because the way you make any type of a forecast or any type of a scientific discovery, which a forecast has the flavor of a scientific discovery, is you have to have the input of several different types of sense perception which are inherently paradoxical to you, such that what is generating those, what's generating the meter readings is not contained in the meter readings itself, but you want to look for the paradoxes between the sense perceptions in order to hypothesize what's actually generating those sense perceptions, which itself is not a sense perception. So, for example, we need to have sensors that are thrown way above the plane of the galaxy. We need to start creating satellites that are accelerated up to somewhere around maybe a quarter to half the speed of light to get outside the plane of our galaxy so that we can get meter readings of the entire galaxy, especially if we're, the phenomena with the Crab Nebula, the acting up of the sun, the acting up of the Earth, what we're seeing is that it's actually a galactic process that's acting up right now.
Mm-hmm.
If we recognize that what's happening on the Earth is driven as part of the process within of the galaxy, then we have to at least get the meter readings of the whole galaxy mm-hmm. in order to do basic predictions and things like that on the Earth.
And then looking at those paradoxes brings us back to the method of Kepler then.
Yeah, exactly. No one, just on a basic level, these people who are looking at precursors, none of them rely on just one meter reading. Each one of them will look at one meter reading, get a sense that something is happening, but then they'll immediately go to some different type of sensing device to try to pick up something that contradicts the first measurement. And if they get the proper set of contradictions, then they can say, oh, what we're seeing is actually a legitimate precursor to an earthquake here. So it's the method of the fact that human sense perception does not give you the whole picture of the universe, but it's mm-hmm. the human mind looking at those senses that can deduce what's creating those senses.
And, Ali, you run into the problem of this form of reductionism every day when you are dealing with things like the national budget, where Obama's slashing everything from NASA to necessary health care. Now they're attacking kidney dialysis for the elderly in Medicare. You run into the same thing on the state level, where we went from the Austrian psychotic fascist Arnold Schwarzenegger to the so-called liberal greenie Jerry Brown, and they have the same policy. Their solution to an economic crisis is to cut everything, especially education. Are people beginning to see the paradox between someone who says the solution is cut the budget, even while we're continuing to bail out bankrupt banks?
Yeah, I think so. I think that people are extremely angry about that. And you see more and more people who are breaking with the so-called Tea Party and the so-called Republican Party line precisely because of that, precisely because what neither of those neither the cutting of the budget, the bailing out of Wall Street, the raising the taxes, none of those actually has a... They understand that none of that is a real solution. because a real solution actually has a commitment to the future and a commitment to the people themselves. And what you're seeing is more and more people are completely being destroyed right now by the lack of a real national idea of economy, a nation that's thinking about the future of their population. You see it with the earthquake preparedness here, even in California, where we went to a hearing the other day where they were saying that here in the North Bay region, if we had an earthquake the size of what Japan just experienced, 80% of hospitals would collapse. A teacher I ran into the other day says, you know, they stopped doing earthquake drills in the school that she works at over the last couple of years. And you're just seeing that in general, what people are getting an instinctual sense of is the nature of this government, this Congress, Obama, and everyone who's around him, these Republicans, they don't care about mankind. They don't care about myself or my future. And the question then becomes, what kind of a policy would have to be taken up by your government, by a government that is thinking at least 50 to 100 years in the future? And that's when you get into what LaRouche is doing. So you definitely have that, that more and more the people who don't agree with us, they say that they're Republicans. They say that they, you know, we need to cut the budget. But they agree with Obama, and they like Obama, and they hate what we're saying about him. And you see more and more that the normal people who actually care about their children and their grandchildren, they're drawn to what we're doing because, you know, be it on all levels, from the political to the scientific level, because what we're taking a look at is that precise question of the future. And right now people don't stand a chance, especially here in California. And the key thing right now is to give them that idea of that reality and to get them to fight, to have the guts to fight and stand up against, you know, all of the so-called ghosts of, you know, the media, Obama, the government, et cetera, and fight for what they know is right, which is their future.
Well, if you look back at the recent history of the United States, Lyndon LaRouche keeps emphasizing the break point that occurred with the assassinations of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. But if you look back in the early 60s, this idea of an extraterrestrial imperative was something that inspired especially young people, but actually everybody, including the World War II generation, the idea that we're going to be able to go outside of the Earth's atmosphere and go out and explore and colonize space. And today, I know this from a campaign I ran in 1990, but I saw it also with Keisha Rogers' campaign and Summer Shields' campaign, where we were talking about going to Mars, and people who should know better were saying, who wants to go to Mars? That's crazy. And yet, that's what the president, John Kennedy, was calling for in the early 60s. And, you know, I'll throw out to both of you, how do we recapture, I mean, do you think this mass strike period does give us the capability to recapture the inspiration and excitement about the extraterrestrial imperative? Peter, why don't you talk about that? Because I know you were studying astronomy precisely because of this reason.
Yeah, I also dropped out precisely because of this reason. I mean,
Dropped out of the academic side of it, not the real side.
Yeah, exactly.
Of it.
Exactly. I mean, all this stuff with we're right now on the cusp of making a major breakthrough, not just in science, but also within the scientific, you know, community around the world. We're about to make a shift in the way science is considered on the planet right now, a shift away from the Newtonian, Darwinian, essentially Sarpian, conception of science that man can't know causes. All he can know is mathematics. We're in the middle of making a complete break out of that. And this issue of the, you know, cosmic relation with tectonic phenomena and the change of life on the Earth, that's the entry point into this, and it goes into biology, it goes into all aspects of science. And so right now, in order to understand any of that, we have to go back into space. We have to have a manned space program. And, you know, some of the scientists who are involved with the Apollo program know that back when, you know, John F. Kennedy said we have to go to the moon, and some people said, well, you know, the line is that we're going to the moon so that we can beat the Russians.
Right.
You know, fine. But the people who were involved in the actual mission of assembling the craft, assembling the policy with the president, knew that the concept was not to beat the Russians. The concept was to get man off the Earth into space, ultimately at that time to Mars. That was the mission. So people who were involved with that mission were also looking at everything that had to do with man in space, which includes looking at the effect of cosmic rays on the magnetosphere, the effect of solar flares and coronal mass ejections from the sun on our ionosphere and magnetosphere, and what the effects would be on life. So all that was being researched. The net was wide open because of the drive into space. So I think, and Ali can say more about this, but I think that the recent emphasis, you know, the immediate emphasis that up until we have until 2013 to make sure that Obama's gone and we have an actual program in place to forecast and determine the origin of things like earthquakes, I think that that's the entry point into reviving the manned space program. Mm-hmm. If we get Obama out of office, you know.
Well, and that's an imperative. And again, I'd encourage people to go to the LaRouche PAC website and get the latest statement that we have up there on the criminal negligence of the administration, and Obama must go. And Ali, I know you've been doing organizing on campuses, and there was just this very large student march a couple of weeks ago in California. At the same time, we're running into the typical parliamentary cretinism of student organizations, which are saying, well, we'll take up Glass-Steagall and things like that later. Right now, we just have to stop the budget cuts. And they don't see the interconnection between the budget cuts and real insanity of the sort that you two have been talking about. But what are you finding on the campuses in general? Are young people at a point where they can be inspired again if there's the quality of leadership necessary?
Well, we're going to inspire them, Harley. I mean, that's really the key. We have to inspire these young people. And one, I would say, when I came out to San Francisco about a year ago or so, I would talk to young people and I would tell them about the space program. And pretty much across the board, you would get this this kind of line of, well, we need to take care of things here on the planet first. But I think more and more with this mass strike process, what has occurred is people are seeing that there can be no dichotomy. You know, just like there's no dichotomy between music, the creativity of, you know, Beethoven composing a piece and Einstein making a discovery in the physical sciences, there's really no dichotomy right now between what needs to be done on Earth and the problems we have on Earth and our absolute imperative to go to space. And young people have always been the most inspired by that. I've never seen the type of situation that I'm seeing right now on the college campuses. And with this march in Sacramento a couple weeks ago, but also in general, we have a lot of outreach that we're going to be doing. We have some teach-ins that we're going to be doing on the campuses here in San Francisco. And what you have is people, they know, the students know that they have no future whatsoever. I rarely run into young people who come out of college who have any kind of a job or anything worth being proud of, worth mentioning even. So they know that there's no future, and that's why they're completely open. Their minds are completely open to what we're talking about and the idea of actual, true, creative, and scientific progress through a space program. You know, this is something that, you know, it's completely transformative because, like Peter said, there definitely is no dichotomy. We've reached a critical point. We've reached a critical point both in terms of what we need if we want to progress in science, if we want to progress in biology, we have to go to astrobiology. If we want to progress and learn about what's going on the Earth with earthquakes and things like that, we have to go and figure out what's going on with the solar system and with the galaxy. And that's becoming clear. And it's becoming clear that the we're being challenged by space, by these larger galactic cycles, to take up these questions ourselves. And, yeah, I think we have an absolutely open situation, but it's going to take us to make that work. It's going to take our leadership and people who know that this is where mankind absolutely must go to really take up that fight and, you know, make sure we can organize young people to come out with us. And I will say that they will be completely open to doing it.
The one thing
we're sick and tired of the boomer paradigm.
The one thing we do know about young people coming out of college is that they have a large debt and no means of covering it. Peter, let me go back to the work that we've done recently on the looking at the Rim of Fire, because this is an incredible discussion and extremely important. Again, it's not taking place in a vacuum, but it's taking place in a context of an immediate threat to literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in the immediate period. We're not saying the extinction of humanity will take place in an instant, but we already can see that potential with the earthquakes in New Zealand, in Japan, in Chile. From the work that you've done and the discussions you've had, what are we looking at in this next year and a half in this current solar cycle in terms of immediate dangers to the west coast of the United States, more activity in the Pacific Rim? There was an earthquake near the island of Crete yesterday. There were more quakes earlier in the week in Japan and elsewhere. This is a highly unstable moment for the planet, isn't it?
Yeah, look, we've been having earthquake swarms in Arkansas over the past several months. Within the past year, there was this wild eruption of the Icelandic volcano. This is a period, you know, look, in the past, organisms have gone extinct. Every single creature on this planet that's ever existed, its kind was doomed to extinction at some point. And there are specific periods in the fossil record where we see drastic drops of like 98% of all types of organisms disappearing 250 million years ago. The only organism that we know of that exists that could possibly avoid that fate is our species, human beings, because we can figure out what the hell knocked these things off. But at this point, every single one of the big extinctions, the causes are not quite explained. Now, we do know that there is a periodic increase and decrease in volcanic activity on the Earth, which includes earthquake activity. What we've seen over the past 2 years is a string of earthquakes large earthquakes, you know, above magnitude 8, that have been hitting around the Ring of Fire, the Chile earthquake, the Japanese earthquake, etc., including volcanic activity, like on the Kamchatka Peninsula. And so it's a matter of time, probably a very short time, before the west coast of the United States gets hit, either along the San Andreas Fault or up in, you know, Seattle, Portland region with the Cascadia subduction zone. But the thing to think about is that right now the sun is coming out of a long period of, you know, slumber, and it's starting to have more and more activity, more and more sunspots. That increase is going to continue into 2013. So if we continue with Obama in the White House over the next, you know, for any period of time without getting rid of him ASAP, then when the big earthquakes start to hit, and there is a clear correlation between solar activity and amount of motion and energy release from earthquakes, if we don't get Obama out really soon, then there's no way the United States is going to be putting into place anything that will be able to forecast where and when these big earthquakes, which we know are going to happen. There's no way of predict. There's no way of having in place a system to forecast when and where exactly they're going to happen, so you can prepare evacuations and things like that.
Well, and what we see is that there's no preparation even of the standard sort, that there was some retrofitting of buildings. But you look at the results of the Bay Area quake from 1989, they've still not even completed rebuilding the Bay Area Bridge. And that's, what, 21 years ago, 22 years ago. So I just want to underscore this point that the removal of Obama is the first thing you do to increase the safety of the American people from being hit by an earthquake. Now, there are plenty of other things we have to do. We've got to get our financial system in order. That means we've got to stop the bailouts. We've got to go back to Glass-Steagall. This is, in a sense, a galactic demand that's being placed on the American people, that where we've been better prepared in the past and thought better in the past, we have a certain amount of protection. So in terms of this question of the overall organizing thrust, Ali, we've just got a few minutes left. What are you doing in the Bay Area then? How can people get involved with us? We're not selling water and beef jerky for people to protect themselves from earthquakes. What can people do with us now to guarantee a better future? Ali, you still there?
Yeah, Harley, sorry. There's a mob of people here. So.
Okay, I was just asking you, what can people do? What are you doing in the Bay Area to activate people to get rid of Obama, get Glass-Steagall, and educate people to understand these kinds of changes that are needed in science policy and science education?
Look, people need to come out with us. One, they need to do a contribution to the LaRouche Political Action Committee and to the campaigns that we're running. Because right now what we're doing with the basement, the type of research that the basement is doing, the type of outreach that the youth are doing, that this organization doing, is the most important thing. So people need to, one, they need to contribute to the website, contribute to our fight. And then they also need to come out and they need to join us. They need to begin to learn and work through these ideas themselves. And we have an emergency town hall meeting here in the Bay Area coming up this Friday, including that's going to be on Friday at the Fort Mason Center. People should come out who are in the area. But also this whole weekend we're going to have a platform conference, a weekend of workshops and ideas going through what people need to know on the Rim of Fire, on the extended sensorium, because it's these people's ability to understand and wield these ideas right now that are going to mean the difference between life or death, extinction or progress and evolution for mankind.
So, Ali, we should put up on the website, if it's not already there, the information on the San Francisco town meeting coming up this next weekend so people can go there. Peter, we have just a little more than a minute. What's the immediate task you're taking up in the basement?
It's to actually assemble a group of all these scientists that are involved with the precursors to create essentially a force, like an advisory force for a president that we should have in order to start dealing with these earthquakes.
And so we'll be getting reports on this up on the website, I'm sure, include as well as updates on the kind of work that the discoveries we're making. Is that a good assumption?
Yep. You got it.
All right. Well, you can see Peter Martinson in a couple of extraordinary interviews with Natalie Lofgren, as well as an interview or two that Peter has done. And keep an eye out for the Summer Shields campaign with the event coming up in the next days, next Friday, actually. And then also the next webcast from Mr. LaRouche will be April 19th. But he will be once again on the weekly report this week, Wednesday. That will be posted by Wednesday afternoon. So there's a lot of activity, but as Ali said, You have to organize for these things as if your life depends on it, because with an angry sun, with a solar system moving into a new phase in the galaxy, your life does depend on what you know and what you don't know. So the ignorance is no excuse. We've got to fight for the real human dynamic in our civilization. So with that, I'd like to thank both Allie and Peter for joining us today. And we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern time. So Peter and Allie, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harley.
Yeah.